You know, in a room that's where there are this many people, of course, there are, as we said earlier, there is a range of different experiences that people are having around the tables, in our own minds, in our own hearts, between us, parts of our stories that are being activated, being told. And I want to draw our attention to the reality that this is a very sacred space. And it's sacred because God makes it so with his very presence. And God was present here this morning long before anybody arrived. Because he knew that we would come looking for someone looking for us. And he's looking for us. It's been happening all day. He looks for us in the eyes and the postures and the greetings and the smiles of those around us at our table, those who are here and surprise us with their presence. But he also comes to find us in ways and in places that are within us. He comes from those spaces in parts of our stories that we have worked really hard for a long time to keep out of our awareness. Parts of our stories that we have for our whole lives told a certain way. Until someone else comes along and asks us a series of questions in which the way the story is told is completely upended. Because healing is always disruptive. And so I'm going to ask us to take 3 minutes. We're going to enter into just a period of listening again. We're going to listen to about 3 minutes of music. So I'm going to invite you to just put your writing tools down. And feel free to close your eyes if you want. And I want to invite you to pay attention to what you're sensing, what you're imaging, what you're feeling, what you're thinking as you hear this particular piece that Ben's now going to play. the first 3 minutes of the second movement of Dvorak's number 9, Symphony for a New World. We're in a large room, but I'm going to ask you to say as loudly as you can, what were you sensing? What were you imaging? What were you feeling? What were you thinking? What was the story that you were telling as you listened to this?
Creation.
Mountains.
Sunrise.
Going
home. Waterfall.
Waterfall is something else.
Going home.
Floating. Oh, you're good, and I can't hear. Okay. Somebody says three people.
I said flowers blooming.
Flowers blooming.
Presence.
Home, but I cannot get there.
Ballerinas.
Peace of mind.
Childhood.
Resurrection.
Going to heaven.
Exploration.
Darkness and light. Exploration.
Being alone.
Father's legacy and
being alone
and joined by someone else. Joined by someone else. We had one who was wondering what she has to do tonight. Glad this piece was working for you. Yep. I'll have to work on that. Right. So let me just suggest. I mean, I just want to say that okay, here's the next question. What did you hear? We heard the bass. French horns, oboes, clarinet, piccolo,
drum roll,
oboe, right. So we hear multiple different instruments that are all deeply dependent upon the presence of some other set of instruments in this to bring this unbelievable beauty to who we are. No one single piece of instrument is going to be able to carry this by itself. Fair enough? I want to suggest to us that when we hear Jesus say, "You are the light of the world," we are, each of us is one of these absolutely necessary pieces of the orchestra. And I also want to invite us to consider that our mission to live like God lives is a mission in which we are called to create a world of goodness and beauty. You are that symphony. But it is not a symphony that will be what it wants to become simply by coming here and listening to it. We have to go home and practice. But when we hear this, we have to go home and practice. Many of us will hear that, okay, I need to go home and practice. It's important to know. Evil wants you to think that you as an individual need to go home and practice this. We have to collectively go home and practice this. We have a daughter who is now an associate pastor at a church in Roanoke, Virginia. And she is an unbelievable preacher. I'm allowed to say that. Her father. She's an unbelievable preacher. And ever since I've been doing this work, and she was in seminary, I mean, she went to Duke Seminary, Duke Divinity School. But she was properly bred to be a University of North Carolina basketball fan. And so when she went for her interview or acceptance or whatever, you know, they were in the interview process, they were going to give, you know, because they give prospective students this paraphernalia, right? Mugs and t-shirts and so forth and so on. And she said, I will accept something that says Duke Divinity School. I won't accept anything that says Duke University. As it should be. From before the foundation of the world. Our daughter in high school became smitten with Latin. And because, I mean, she was smitten with Latin because she was smitten with Latin when she was in elementary school. They went to a Christ-centered school where they taught Latin. But she was not just smitten with Latin because of Latin. Like, let's be clear. Like, nobody's just smitten with Latin. I mean, we're all glad Latin's here, but like, no, she was... Whatever. But she was smitten with Latin because of her high school Latin teacher who gave our daughter Rachel the experience of what it means to be known deeply for what she most passionately loved. And Latin led to Greek, and Greek led to Hebrew. And all that led to a classics major at Furman University, and all that led to Duke Divinity School. And by the time she was in the middle of all this, she and I are having conversations about what Paul writes in Romans chapter 12. Now, you know, it's one thing, I'm computer technology, I'm like somewhere around 1968. I'm like 6 years old when it comes to technology. And I'm okay with that because I just need to know how to keyboard things and like check email and so forth. I don't need to know everything there is. And so when I'm around my kids and when it comes to technology, and they know tons more than I do, it doesn't really shame me that much because I don't expect to know that much about technology. I'm cool with that. But you know, there are things that you think you know that you always know more than your children know about. And one of those things has to do with like things of the kingdom, right? So here is my daughter teaching me Paul's Greek, right? And here's the thing, like, it's just the coolest thing. Because as I'm talking about some of this interpersonal neurobiology and we're talking about Romans chapter 12, she says, you know, Dad, this whole notion that when Paul writes in Romans chapter 12, therefore, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You know, he's doing that whole pronoun thing again. Like, I didn't even know that Paul had pronouns. And now our daughter is saying, like, you know, no, that whole thing about the transformed by the renewing of your mind. She's like, that's a plural word. But the word mind is singular. Your collective mind. But you see, I read that text, and I think that Paul is just talking to Kurt. I think that Kurt's job is to go home and make sure that God renews Kurt's mind. And it's true that God's intending to do that. What's not true is that God intends for Kurt to do this by himself. Our minds are not intended to be renewed by themselves. They're not made neurobiologically to do that. We are not made neurobiologically to tell our stories in isolation. There's a gentleman by the name of James Cone, C-O-A-N. He's a neuropsychologist at the University of Virginia. And Jim has done some really amazing work, research projects with college students because you can get them to do just about anything for food. And one of the experiments that he's done is he puts them in a functional MRI scanner. Magnetic resonance imaging scanner, and a functional MRI, an fMRI scanner, checks on blood flow, and that helps us indirectly measure the activity, real-time activity of the brain, so that we can see how the brain is responding under particularly stressful situations. So Jim does two things he's measuring. He puts, he'll have the student be in the fMRI scanner, and while he does, he applies a mildly painful stimulus to them, right? So he shocks them. And then he measures up what we call the corticospinal tracts of your spinal cord. He measures how much somatic pain is registering for this person when they feel the mild shock on their foot. But the other thing that he's measuring is the relative degree of stress that the brain is undergoing while they do that. So he's measuring two kinds of distress, somatically registering pain and emotional distress in the fMRI scanner. And then after he does this, we repeat the measure. We always like repeating painful measures. Repeats the measure, only this time, he invites the student to have join them one of their very close friends or a family member with whom they feel deeply emotionally connected. And they hold their hand. And they do the same thing all over again. And here's what the data says. What that student registers in terms of felt physical pain doesn't change at all. They still feel the same degree of physical pain. But their emotionally expressed sensation of distress drops through the basement. Now, Cohn is not a person of faith, but he makes this interesting observation. And the observation is, you know, for years we have come to understand what a normal human adult fMRI scan looks like. You just pop one of us into the fMRI scanner and take a look at it under normal circumstances, non-stressful circumstances, and this is what a normal human adult brain looks like. And you do this thousands of times, and you get a composite picture of what an average normal brain looks like. And he said, and for the longest time, we've just assumed that what a singular brain looks like is what normal is. He said, but what if it turns out that what normal is in fact what the brain looks like when one brain is connected to another? Are you with me? What if normal is really what we experience when we are deeply emotionally connected to another human being? And that this previously understood normal fMRI scan is what my brain looks like when I am isolated and distressed. It just doesn't look like distress because everybody else around that we're sticking in the fMRI scan looks just like me. And this person, Jim Cohn, is not even a Trinitarian. Like, he's not a believer. But you see, let us make mankind in our image to live like we live together. All the more evidence for what it means for the first couple in the second chapter of Genesis, all the more for what it means for them to come to this precipice, the edge of creativity, but being both naked and unashamed. What they are on the verge of creating is Dvorak. They get something else. The story that God wants to tell with and for all of us is a story that requires our being open to vulnerability, being attuned to the 8 different domains of our mental processes, without shame being in the conversation, recognizing that in order to produce a world of goodness and beauty, we need the presence of other people to pull it off. That's where we stand at the end of Genesis chapter 2. And then a different kind of storytelling takes place. And this storytelling that takes place that is different takes place in a context of what we would call attractive differences. Now, it's curious to me. I'm pretty aware of what it. I don't know how this is going to sound, but I'm just going to say it. Okay. I'm pretty aware of what it is about women that men find to be attractive. I'm just going to put it out there, right? I'm just going to say it. Look, we all know it. We all like. I'm pretty aware of that, right? There's certain features about women that men find to be attractive. Fair enough. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
All right. Yes, thanks be to God, right. I felt like I was hanging out there alone for just a moment, But this gentleman came to my rescue. Dude, yeah, right, right, right. I will tell you that there are days, there are times when even though I understand factually, abstractly with my left brain the answer to this question, it's still a little strange to me what it is about men that women find attractive. Like, you know what I mean? I mean, like, not like we're like awful, you know, to be around. But there's a part of me that sometimes wonders, like, I don't get it. Like, I'm not quite sure what it is about me that you would find to be so attractive. Like, I don't feel like I'm off-putting. You know, like I'm poison ivy or something. Like, this is gonna be awful. But I just say, like, I'm not really quite sure that I get it. And maybe the women are saying, like, no, we don't either. We don't get it either. We've been trying to stop this for like 300,000 years. Here's the point. There are many, many things about us as gender, right? Females and males, right? That's how we were made. That's how God made us, right? In the beginning. There are many things about us as gender that are very similar. Like that we have the same, like we have two eyes, a nose, a mouth, right? Two hands, two legs, right? There are lots of them. We have one brain, one heart, long, like most of our physicality and most of how our brains operate in general are actually very, very similar. But the parts of us that are different are infinitely different. And I don't just mean physically, sexually. I mean, there are parts of us that seem so different that we really almost, if we find it impossible to see connection points. Does that make sense? As I tell people, I didn't really want to marry a woman. I wanted to marry a much, much more beautiful version of me. Mm-hmm. Amen. He said, right. And that, in fact, is not, I just got the much more beautiful version. I just got them, but not the version of me. There are certain things that where Phyllis and I have many things in deep commonality. But those places where we are different, there are moments where it feels infinitely different. Does that make sense? Yeah, right, right, yeah. And the thing is, like, there are many moments when that difference is really, it's okay. Like, it's okay with me that you get to have labor and I don't have to. That wasn't a good joke. There are moments when those differences don't seem to matter that much. And then there are moments when it feels like that's all that matters. And it's in those moments, and what's different, by that, I don't just mean that, like, she is a female and I'm a male. I just mean she is having, at this moment, a very different emotional experience of the event that we're trying to talk about than what I'm having. Right? I'm over here, she's over there, but it does, like, it's not just about marriage. Like, this is with any two parties in the world. This is Jews and Arabs. This is blacks and whites, right? Democrats and Republicans. This is who we are. This was Adam and Eve. After their story started to change. But before their story started to change, I want to suggest to us that these differences that were waiting on the precipice were that which were destined to make their capacity for creativity what it was intended to be. And so I want to suggest to us, as we roll into shame, as we begin to talk about it now, And then we roll into it further tomorrow. I want to suggest to us that, you know, we see shame. We see this thing as like, it's just this nasty thing. And we got to get rid of this. And I want to suggest to us that it is in those places where we feel this the most, that Jesus is coming for us. I would much rather Jesus be a surgeon. Give me general anesthesia. Wake me up in the morning when it's all done. Don't show me my wound. Don't invite me to have to be part of this rehabilitation process. I just want to wake up and have my new self. I want the story to be told with me unconscious. I don't want to have to be part of the renewing, the storytelling process. Why can't I just magically wake up one day and be totally okay with what it was like for me growing up in my family? Why can't John just wake up one day and say, hey, Jesus came, he saved me, and he saved me from that father of mine who was an SOB and who stuck me in that creek in the middle of January, but now everything is cool. And you know what? For the life of him, that just isn't working for John. This is the thing. In these places where we have infinite differences with our enemies, and those enemies may be the people we are married to, those enemies may be our siblings, those enemies may be our parents, our children, they may be our friends who were our friends, who are now not our friends, those people may be in our church, they probably are. They could be the person who fired me, they could be the person that I just fired. They could be this imagined person with whom I have no relationship, but who somebody elected or who somebody didn't elect. You know how this goes. And we feel deeply these fractures. And we really don't want those fractures to be there. We want them to go away. And we see Jesus coming and saying, we have work to do, and we have work to do right there in that place. And you're like, really? This is really going to happen? Yep, this is really going to happen. And tomorrow we're going to see how he does it. And the first couple were on this verge, being naked and unashamed, on the verge with their extensively different differences, waiting to create. And I want to suggest to us that it is in those places where we feel enmity the most that the energy and the potential for creativity is waiting for us. And it scares the living daylights out of us. It does. It scares the living daylights out of us, which is why we so desperately need others who are going to help us do this. The reason that it frightens us so much is not just because it's scary, it's because in our minds, we only see ourselves doing this by ourselves. We only see ourselves doing this by ourselves. It's important to know as well, healing of our shame is not just about fixing an old wound. It is about commissioning you for new vocational liberation. It is not just about taking something that is broken and bringing it back to baseline. It is bringing it and taking it someplace you could never have dreamed it could go. If I were to ask you now, you could probably do this on a piece of paper. Write down the name of one person, because these things always involve people. Write down the name of one person where relational fracture currently exists for you. Go ahead, write it down. Here's the thing, we won't wanna write it down. I'll tell you why. Your brain knows. The minute that you write it down, it becomes far more real. And once you write the name down, I'm gonna ask you this question. What would interacting with that person look like if shame were not permitted to be in the room? Complex systems. Complex systems in physics is related to a thing that many of us have heard, chaos theory and so forth. For those of you who have background in this, this notion of even like the butterfly effect, right? Where small input leads to large output. In Newtonian, Isaac Newton, remember that guy? Right? Isaac Newton, we talk about Newtonian physics. And Newtonian physics were the kind of physics that let us know that we can know that we know that we know that a certain, if an apple were to drop, that the drop's at a constant speed, whether you drop it in Australia or you drop it in Kansas. It's constant. We know, predict. These guys that come along like Heisenberg and Einstein, and they talk about theories of relativity and quantum mechanics and so forth, they say, no, life is actually not all that certain after all. It's predictable. We can predict it. We can predict probabilities, but we can't be certain. Which, in fact, is what relationships are much more like, right? Relationships are not certain. Relationships are only able to be probably predicted. In complex systems, we start with small input and get large output. In linear systems, in Newtonian physics, we get the same output as the input. You know the those little like contraptions that you sit on a desk, and they are like five steel balls suspended in little strings, right? And if you take, or five or six or however many, you take one ball and you hit them, how many balls go? One. One for one. You take two, how many go? Right. The same input gives you the same output. These are linear physics. Quantum mechanics says you put one ball, five go. This is how the brain works. It's a complex system. This is how human relational systems work. It's a complex system. What does that mean? It means that all it takes is a small amount of shame to begin to creep into systems and enlarge itself exponentially and even geometrically. It only takes a small amount of shame, as we might say, to poison the whole well. But I would say this. In the same way, God is also working within the same physics structure, and he will say, all it takes is a mustard seed of faith. All it takes is the willingness to do one thing, one time. Practice one time and you'll practice twice. If you practice twice, you'll practice four times. If you practice four, you'll practice eight times. And before it's all said and done, beauty and goodness is everywhere. But it takes time. It will not be delivered by Amazon. Amazon is not going to give you goodness and beauty. Because why? Because it doesn't take long enough. This is what the first couple was sitting upon, and this is what we now sit upon, this precipice of creation, of goodness and beauty. But we're having to overcome something. Because unfortunately, we don't live in a world in which we are vulnerable and unashamed. We are vulnerable, and we've got the shame of the entire history of the world behind us. So one wonders, right? At the beginning of Genesis chapter 3, one wonders, what's actually going on? The first thing that we see, of course, is this sentence that says, and the serpent was the what? Was the craftiest of all the creatures that the Lord God had placed in the garden. The craftiest. To be crafty means it is my intention to fool you. Anybody here like being fooled? You're like, you really like look like, yeah, I hope somebody really makes me look silly today at work. No, we don't like being fooled. It's important to know. It is evil's intention to fool you. It is evil's intention to destroy you. It is evil's intention to deceive you. It is evil's intention to break you. It is evil's intention, as C.S. Lewis would say, to devour you. If you leave here, if you came here without being consciously aware that you have a bullseye on your chest, you are not awake, you are not alert, you are not attuned. You are not fully conscious. It is his intention to do this. Now, it's interesting about shame. We said this morning, we talked a little bit about Brené Brown and all the stuff that she talked about, which is really brilliant and beautiful. But when we talk about shame in the literature, you'll read it as just something that happens to happen to be in the universe, like a virus. It just happens to be here, these things that we experience that we call shame. But we don't think that shame, like, is smart. We don't think that shame is trying to trip us up. We don't think that evil really means to make us feel bad so that we stop creating. But the biblical narrative would suggest that that, in fact, is the case. It is evil's intention. He is crafty. And this Mr. Crafty begins a conversation with the woman. And he asks a question: is it true? And they engage in this conversation. You'll notice the conversation doesn't actually last that long. And there's no indication that the serpent has any need or desire for his own notoriety. He's not doing this for the purpose of making a name for himself. In fact, he enters into the story and leaves the story without much fanfare. It's announced that he's Mr. Crafty. At the end of the conversation with the woman, you don't even hear anybody, the narrator of the story does not say, and the snake left the scene, exit stage right. It doesn't say this. It doesn't give him really the time of day, because evil is not really interested in being known. It's not interested in, like, being famous. It's interested in devouring you. But the question is, in what story do we believe we're living? If we just think that shame is an artifact in the world, we do so to our peril. And over the course of this conversation that the woman and the snake have, things begin to happen. And before it's all said and done, something happens within her, because at some point evil says, well, you know, it's not really true that you'll die. You won't die. In fact, God knows, not only will you not die, but God knows that in the day you eat thereof, you will become like him. Now, we read this text, and immediately after this, the woman says, and the scripture says, that she looked and could see that the tree and the fruit was good for wisdom, for knowledge, all those things. And then she goes and she eats the fruit, and then she gave some to her husband. I think, like, dang, that all happened pretty fast. It's like a 10-minute conversation, if that. Anybody here ever read C.S. Lewis's Paralandra? Book Paralandra? May have, like, so Paralandra is C.S. Lewis's fictional science story about God making a new kingdom on the planet Venus. And there is a new first couple. And the devil enters into a human who goes to Venus to try to tempt her. And this conversation lasts for weeks. And I'm thinking, like, well, that's because women like to talk. Oh, come on. It's 4:17. I've been working hard up here. Come on. I have a patient who's now in her 60s. When she was 19, she lives on the East Coast, when she was 19, her father came to her and said, her father, by the way, whom she adored, her father, who was a faithful husband, father, church member, citizen, you name it. Her father comes to her at age 19 and says, I need to let you know that I'm leaving your mom and I'm moving to Seattle, where I have another family. Really? They do that in America? Yep. You can't make this stuff up. Now, of course, he told her, it's not your fault. Of course he told her this. And of course, she didn't believe him. Because if your father, whom you adore, as it turns out, doesn't want to have anything more to do with you, it doesn't matter why he's leaving. Are you with me? And it won't matter how much rationale he gives her. All she knows is that he's not really telling her just something about himself and about his new family. He's telling her something very powerfully about her. He's telling her whether he knows it or not, you are not enough to keep me here. And she won't even consciously be aware that this is the message that she is taking in, that this is the story that she is now telling. But it is, in fact, the story that is being woven in her mind. Let me ask you this. If any of us were Eve, and this serpent comes and has this conversation with us and says, no, your God, as it turns out, your father, he doesn't really want you to become like him. He knows that if you have this, you will be like him. You will have what he has you. Now imagine, you see, we read this text, and it's easy for us to just assume, well, I could see that the tree was what I wanted, and so I took it. But I'm wondering, if it's true that Eve and Adam have such a wonderful relationship with their father, with their God, what is there that's going on here that's pushing her over the edge? She's got no motivated reason for eating fruit. It's important to know this. Human beings do not ever do things ultimately because things make sense. Do you know that? We don't do things. We make sense of things that first feel right to do. Right? The brain works bottom to top and right to left. No one makes a course correction. I'm living in Eden with my husband. Things are great. And suddenly, this serpent drops a couple of new facts onto my table and I go eat the fruit that's been sticking around me for a long time that I haven't had any reason to eat. And I just go eat it, like after a 5-minute conversation. Really? What is it like to hear from this person, your dad doesn't want you becoming like him? What's it like for our 19-year-old to hear, your dad is leaving for Seattle? I don't know. I wasn't there. And it's important that we not inappropriately over-psychologize the scriptures. It's very important that we not do that. It's also equally important to know that if we cannot apply what we understand about human psychology to the scriptures, they've got nothing to say to us. But I'm going to invite you to consider this. I'm going to invite you to consider that a couple of things were happening in this story. That first of all, to hear this message that your father knows that in the day you become like him, that's not a good thing. That is not just the snake telling the woman something about God. That is the snake telling the woman something about the woman. And evil, just so you know, is really smart. Evil is not going to come to your door tomorrow and say, hey, I've got a great idea. Let's go rob a bank. Evil is never that direct. We like to say, evil does its best work in the middle of good work being done. It does its best work in the middle of good work being done. It waits till God makes a garden and then joins to find out how it can disrupt it. It waits until you have a fairly well-established relationship with this person that you can trust. And then you start to ask questions. And you're not just asking questions to change the facts. You're asking questions to harness what we said earlier is the primary fuel source in the mind, and that is emotion. Emotion, emote, emote. It's the Latin for that which precedes movement. I want to suggest to us that Eve's movement to eat the fruit is a way for her to regulate what first emerges as the distress of shame that happens in the conversation between her and the snake long before any tree gets approached. And that's exactly what we've been doing ever since. We feel distress, and we will then turn right. And she looked and saw that the tree was good for everything I need to cope with what is not okay now. We're going to hear tomorrow about how it is that shame is primarily an emotional state that is constantly at work, and evil is using it. Evil is constantly using it to disrupt our stories and to tell a very different story than the one God wants to be telling with us. We're also tomorrow going to discover how it is that we go from this first conversation between the woman and the snake, how we go from there to where we are now. But tomorrow we're also going to go a long way in discovering how it is that God is not afraid of shame. Not afraid of it. In fact, we would say that God created a universe in which shame happens to be part of it. And God very much intends for us to respond to it in the same way that Jesus has modeled for us. How do we respond to this both as individuals, but primarily in community? We've been talking a bit already. We'll talk more in the early morning tomorrow about what the really awful news about shame is. But by the end of the day tomorrow, we're going to see that the news about shame is truly far better than you can imagine. Far, far better than you can imagine. And so with that, I'm going to stop my part of this part, and we're going to take some time for Q&A, and we'll have a couple of folks. We've got about half an hour for that. Hey, and I just want to say, does it feel like you've been working? Yeah. Dang right you have been, right? I just want to say, like, well done. I'm serious. Like, this is not easy to do. I mean, I don't mean what I'm doing. I'm like, what you're doing. Like, it's not easy to do. And I'm really impressed and pleased with what you're doing. Right, you give yourselves a hand, right? It's not easy to do.
So I'm kind of ashamed to ask this, but not really.
Oh, good. We're in good company.
So you're equating shame with sin in Eve's taking the apple. Is shame always sin?
So the question is, are we equating shame with sin here? Is that right? Is that the question? Let me suggest this. Let me ask a question. When was sin committed in the Garden of Eden? When? Before she ate. Before she ate, okay. Anybody, any other thoughts? I'm sorry? When she what? No, when she, so she sinned when she wanted to be like God. Does the text tell us that she wanted to be like God? No? Right, okay. When did she sin? When she ate. When she ate, right. So let me ask you this. Did she sin once she'd picked the apple? Did she sin when her lips were on the apple, but she'd not bitten the apple? What, did she sin when she'd eaten the apple, but she hadn't swallowed the apple? Does it only qualify after she has her first bowel movement of the apple? Oh, that's a consequence, right? That's right. That's right. Poop is the wrath of God. If it hadn't been for Adam and Eve, think of all the diapers we wouldn't be able to sell. All right, okay. All right, but I think you get my point. Here's the thing. First of all, I want to suggest this, that shame, as we'll see tomorrow in more detail, shame, I'm not equating shame with sin. First of all, the Bible does not, unless I'm misunderstanding, the Bible does not, in a Webster's form, define sin. There's no place where the Bible says sin equals this. What sin is something that we interpret from the texts. Would that be fair to say? And it's generally considered that sin is this way in which we miss the mark, right? Miss the mark. Whatever that means, though, because nobody says what is the mark? And let me just suggest this. Okay, I want to say this. So there is this lovely book called The Master and His Emissary. You'd really enjoy it. It's 500 pages, okay? The first 250 of the book, it's written by a guy named Ian McGilchrist. He's a British psychiatrist. The first 250 pages of the book address the differences between the right and the left hemisphere, how they work. The second 250 pages address the question of how it is that we have become a dominantly left hemispheric culture and why this is problematic. He's not a believer, but I want to suggest something that comes out of this that directly addresses the question that we have here. The title of the book, The Master and His Emissary, suggests that, first of all, there once was a master, there was a king who was the ruler over all the land, but who had several emissaries. And one of those emissaries usurped the king's role and took over the role that belonged rightfully to the king. And in McGilchrist's language, the right hemisphere is the master. The right hemisphere is out of which so much of who we are as humans come. But we, instead of just simply interpreting this with our left brains have now taken over the role. So that so much of what our life now boils down to, it must be right, it must be logical, it must be linear, it must fit into all kinds of categories. We speak mostly through and to the left brain when it is the right brain that is running the show. You know, the news, for instance, is not good for preachers. Not good. Right? Because if you like to preach for 45 minutes, it's important to know that within 30 minutes of your 45-minute sermon, whoever's been listening to it, unless they have taken rigorous notes and plan on studying those notes for several days in a row after the sermon, I don't know anyone who does this, within 30 minutes will have forgotten 90% of your sermon. Not because they want to, not because they don't care, but because so much of how we preach sermons is preached to the left hemisphere. We exegete texts. Not a bad thing to do. The problem is that unless I'm willing to study afterwards, I'm not going to remember very much because of how the brain works. What's this got to do with the question about, are we equating shame with sin? What I want to say is this. We really want to know what sin is and where it happens. And the reason I want to know is because I don't want to make the mistake. I want to know where the line is. I want to know what sin is and what it isn't so that I don't do that. Because if I do, I will be ashamed. I will be in trouble. You with me? Now, this doesn't mean that it's improper to ask that question. Where is it? What is it? Those are all reasonable things. I'm simply saying that often when we ask those questions, and I'm not suggesting that you have, saying that sometimes when we ask those questions, We're doing so because we want to make sure that we know where the line is. I need to know that I know that I know in order for me not to make mistakes, because life is about playing to keep from losing and not about playing to win. I would suggest this. Where sin happened in the garden, like where it actually took place, I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm not that smart. But I will say this, that shame as an affect, as an emotional state, is that which I believe evil wields with everything that we call sin to happen. I don't know that there's anything that we do that we call sin is done in the absence of shame. And we're gonna like learn tomorrow about, well, at least why I think that is true. But it's important to know, shame emerged in the garden as a natural consequence of certain behaviors. The real question for us is not, is shame a good or bad thing? The real question is this: when we experience it, what do we do? What do we do with it? What do we do in response to it? So much of what we have done historically now is to have practiced our coping strategies that we don't even know most of the time when shame's happening. It's already like a mile in our rearview mirror before we even know that it's taken place. And so I would suggest, so to answer the question, like sin, you know, if we say that sin really is this turning away from the relationship with God, if that is what sin ultimately is about, that it can be measured in terms of like, I'm turning away from God, away from relationship. We'll see tomorrow how it is that shame propagates that. It doesn't make it happen, but it puts fuel in the tank that makes it much easier for us to want to do that. I don't know if that's helpful.
I have a question. This side.
Yes.
How did you help John and Steve?
Who paid you? John's story will be completed tomorrow. As will Steve's. Because they have different outcomes. They have very different outcomes. We're going to talk about them both tomorrow, right? It's a great question. I mean, it's legitimate, right? But not for today.
You personify evil.
Uh-huh.
Are you meant to call it Satan? Is that intentional?
The question is, the statement is, I personify evil. I call it evil. I don't call it the Satan. Let me just say this. What do we understand that the word the Satan means? The accuser. I don't know that that's the only thing that it means. All right, there are lots of other, there's other biblical imagery, biblical motif for this. But there are a couple things that the Bible, I mean, that it does have in common. One is this notion of accusation, right? And there is the accuser. Fair enough? And to accuse is an intentional activity, right? It's not somebody who accidentally runs over somebody that they didn't see in traffic, right? It's somebody who's looking for a pedestrian on the sidewalk and runs them over anyway. Fair enough? And so I call it evil because I call it evil with a capital E. You know, I don't know, I don't understand about, you know, like, well, where is and who is and what is Satan and so forth. Like, I don't know the answer to that question. I can only, all I can say, and this is as a psychiatrist, I can say, like, I do believe in an intentional, personal evil that is at work in the world. And the Bible has different names for this, called the Lucifer, the Satan, evil. I just happen to call it that for that reason, not because I don't have any particular, I mean, it's just a general term that I use. If that makes sense? Yeah. I think part of our challenge is, again, as we'll see tomorrow when we talk about Jesus. We said following Jesus is hard to do. And the reality is that if we live like Jesus lived, we're going to find that we are up early and we are up late praying. But we've got kids. And we've got iPhones. Well, not this group anymore, right? Right, I'm not kidding. Okay. So recently I've just been through a period of time that's been challenging for me. Really challenging. I told you a little bit about that, this unearthing of this story about parents and attachment and so forth for me. And it involves a couple of other things too for me that have been really difficult. And in the wake of this, I have begun, oddly enough, to read the book of Revelation. You're thinking like, you know, you get to the back of the Gideon's Bible. When in emotional trouble, read the book of Revelation. Like, who does that? Like, nobody does that. But it is the revelation of Jesus Christ, right? So for a whole host of reasons, and I've never read the book of Revelation before fully through, like in my life. Our church just finished a 6-week preaching series on it. And in the course of where I happened to be, I began to read it. And you get to the third chapter, the end of the seventh letter to the seven churches, the church at Laodicea, which, as it turns out, was a really wealthy church. Super wealthy town. Like Dallas. He's like, well, we don't live in Dallas, we live in Stonebriar. Like, okay, I get it. You are not hot or cold, and I'm gonna spit you out of my mouth. Now, how many of us, like, when we imagine our older brother Jesus coming to us and saying, like, dude, we got things to talk about. Like, that's not the Jesus I think about talking with. That makes sense? All that to say that there is a sense in which the seriousness with which we grapple with following Jesus is easily interrupted by our consumerist materialism. And if we live in this country, pretty much across the board, we're going to have to grapple with that. We have to address that. Following Jesus is really hard to do. And being up early and up late, doing the work that Jesus did, as far as I can tell, and doing it in community is the only way we're going to do this. Yes.
Will you be addressing tomorrow connections between shame and blame? Blame of self versus blame of others?
Yes.
Okay, because there's a difference between blame and personal responsibility taking, which you've invited us to all throughout the day, accepting the responsibility to do hard things, to learn things, to apply things, to learn our stories.
Right.
But as a clinician, I find that a lot of times when people begin to talk about their story, they shift blame that they felt towards themselves, and they just place it on someone else. And that's not terribly healing.
Right. We're going to talk about the word blame. The English word blame is not really found in Scripture. The word condemnation is. And we're going to talk about that a lot tomorrow. Okay. Along with John and Steve and several other things we'll be putting on. So, yes. Yeah, we will.
Hi, sorry. I wanted to ask a question on the last session, but pertaining to...
I'm sorry. I'm looking for you.
Oh, sorry, you're here.
Oh, there you are, right there.
I wanted to ask a question.
Looking for you, looking for me.
The question I want to ask is pertaining to, the fall of mankind, but it's kind of like a question I can hear my 6-year-old asking in my head, and it's freaking me out. So I'll just wait and see if you answer more of that tomorrow, because it's probably hugely theologically I can't wrap my head around it, and he's asking really great questions. So that
your 6-year old is.
Yes, yes.
Well, so, well, those are the best kinds. Really.
So I'll save that till after tomorrow, if in case you address it. But I want to know if you would be addressing in the part on prayer about there seems to be like a movement in the last, you know, as far as I'm aware of, like 10 years in like the prayer counseling or the return to a memory and all this. And I feel like sometimes that can get really, really introspective, but I was really interested in the stories that you told about having an explicit memory but no emotion attached to it whatsoever. And I was wondering if you were going to address just like practices or ways that is healed, because when you mentioned like Jesus pry that open with the crowbar,
right,
sometimes that's the way it happens. But I was just wondering, right, what else, if you were going to say.
Well, yeah, I can speak to some of that even now. I mean, because someone else asked me, like, are we going to address in more explicit ways what we do about explicit and implicit? Somebody else asked that question in one of the breaks. So we'll just say this. One of the things that's actually very, very different about our culture than the culture that wrote and read the Bible is that, you know, we do tend to live fairly individualistic lives, right? That's not, I mean, but this is by intention, right? This is liberal democracy writ large. Are you with me? These are plausibility structures. This isn't, pardon me, this isn't just about theology. This is an intention. This is the Industrial Revolution. This is modernity. This is the atomization of human beings. You with me? That we're all a product of. That is antithetical to the biblical nature of how we were created to live. Now, the biblical story does not tell us that we should be living like also some Eastern cultures live, where whatever I have is yours, and it's yours, and it's yours, and it's yours. Like, there is no sense of myself, right? Because we in the West have cornered the market on individualism, and in the East have cornered and kept the market on a community such that the individual doesn't really even seem to exist. But the biblical narrative has us in this place where the notion of who we are is clear. It is clear, but it is clear in the context of community. And the community has an awareness of who it is based on its collection of the particular individuals that are part of it. This is the kingdom of God. In complex systems, we're going to get to your question. In complex systems, we are constantly doing this work of creating a system, an emerging system, right? The mind is an emergent process, an emerging system that is in between extremes of rigidity and chaos. In physics systems that work well, that are flexible, adaptive, coherent, energized, and stable, those systems are operating in between the two extremes of rigidity and chaos. Rigidity being, anybody here ever feel stuck? Okay, two things. If you feel stuck, that part of your life that feels stuck, shame is in play. Shame is in play, and that part is missing connection with other people. It's always the case. That is a rigid, neurobiologically, we would say that part of us is functioning rigidly. And by rigidity, we also mean that a system, everything in the system functions the same. No, like, it's rigid, it's not moving. A chaotic system is a system in which all the parts are going hither and yon. This would be, in its extremes and most malignant form, what happens in anarchy, in political systems, right? Anarchy, this would be something that where everything has to be the same. Everything has to be, this is anarchy over here. You're with me, right? A system that is integrated, as we've been using, a system that is integrated, really balances between these two things. What's that got to do with implicit and explicit memory? It is my understanding of the degree to which I, as an individual, tell my story, and I'm also having plenty of help from those others who are helping me to tell this story. Does that make sense? But for instance, in my story with the puppy, in that moment, like, I was not really part of the storytelling mechanism, right? Like, the puppy's gonna leave, nobody's gonna tell me about this. Like, the story of the system is gonna be told, and Kurt doesn't really get any input in this. Does that make sense? Now, if you're seven, you're not really aware. Like, well, gosh, my parents haven't done enough therapy work because the puppy's gone, nobody's talking about this. We need to see somebody, right? As a seven-year-old, I'm not saying these things to myself. I don't know what I don't know. I'm not really invited in to become part of that storytelling venture. Somebody else is doing all the storytelling. I'm not invited to be part of it. Or there are times when, like, only I am telling the story because I'm getting no help from anybody else. There are frequently times when, because I've not had help or because I've had to do this all by myself, my explicit memory, what I am able to tell about what I remember factually and with time travel, I can do that on my own, but the implicit elements of this have not been afforded to me because I don't have anybody coming to me to ask me things like, what do I feel? What do I sense? What do I image? No one is attuned to my mind such that those implicit parts of my brain can be brought to the story. Does that make sense? And they're left out of that. So what do we do with this? Here's one thing that you can do. I don't know if any of you have ever done this or not. You can begin the process of writing your autobiography. We have people do this frequently. Now, when we do it, important to know a couple things. We want you to handwrite it. We don't want you to keyboard it. We want you to handwrite it because, not because keyboarding is bad. If you can't handwrite it, you can keyboard it. But keyboarding allows you to do a lot fairly automatically and without thinking. It allows you to do things pretty quickly that circumvents your brain's capacity to connect with stuff that otherwise, if it's slowed down, it has the chance to connect with. And so if you have to longhand your story, you give your brain a time to catch up to things that you otherwise may have not thought about forever. So, you take 30 to 60 minutes and you start with your earliest memory and you handwrite the first 10 years of your life. We're not looking for war and peace, okay? Just to be clear. You don't have to write everything in absolute chronological detail or order. You're just gonna write what you sense, what you image, what you feel, what you think. So we have this little acronym for the mind, right? To sift your mind, S-I-F-T. I add a letter B, right? Sift B. We sense, we image, we feel, we think, and we behave. For many of us who don't have a lot of implicit memory added to our explicit memory, we don't have a lot that we sense or image or feel when we talk about these things that we explicitly recall. The writing of our memory for 30 to 60 minutes, you get what you get, right? You don't have to have everything, and then you give yourself a week. And then you come back and you're gonna write about the next 10 years of your life. Do that, and then the next 10 years of your life, until you've written all about your life. And so let's say that you're 38 years old, so you have 4 decades worth that you've written. And then you're gonna find who that person or persons are by whom you were deeply known, and you're gonna read them your autobiography. You're like hell I will. We say that down here in Texas. You try to make me, I'll get out my gun. How many people have I talked with, you know, people who we've invited, so like, we'd like you to write your autobiography, and they, you know, they have a seizure right there in the office. Because it's bad enough to think about certain things about your story, let alone to make them that much more real because you have put them on material paper. You watch. To make something material is to make it real. And here's something else. Real change in human beings, regeneration, reconciliation, renewal of the mind, if it is not embodied, it's not real. It doesn't make any difference to us if it's not embodied. If I can't sense it, if I can't feel it, it hasn't happened. You're like, wait a minute. What about those libraries of theology that tell us what's happened? Like, we're not saying things haven't happened somewhere out there in the ether. But as far as we are concerned, if it hasn't happened in a way that I can sense and image and feel, it doesn't matter. Look, if the blind guy that Jesus heals, if Jesus says, hey, like, dude, no, you can see. And he's like, I really still can't see. It doesn't really matter to him. When we write these things, we make them that much more real. You make it, you can imagine, that much even more real when you allow someone else to carry it with you. Because, and of course, this is what our patients would like to do. Well, Kurt, okay, I'll at least write it. And then can I just like write it and then that'll be it? Like, no, I want you to come in. We're going to read it to me. And they're like, some of them, like, they don't come back. Right? Because if they give their story to someone else, who knows what they will do with it? This is why evil wants to use shame to make sure that your story gets no further than the inside of your head. In the course of doing this, over time, we create opportunities for more of our implicit memory to become known and for our implicit and explicit memory to become integrated. But we do so in a context in which we are being heard and in which the story is being shepherded in the presence of someone else. This is not intended to be our job to do this all by ourselves. Does that make sense? Does what help?
What you just explained. That you're writing out your story and then reading.
Right. So I'm going to answer this by telling this story. Anybody here recently been to the Sears Tower in Chicago? What used to be the Sears Tower? Now the Willis Tower? Or maybe. Right. Right. If you go to the Sears Tower, right, in the last, 10, 15 years, they put in these, on the observation deck, these huge retractable blocks, right? They go out about 8 feet maybe, right? And they're about what? Maybe 7 feet by 8 feet, something like that. 7 by 8 by 8, something like that. And they're acrylic boxes that are on these huge bicycle chains. And they retract them at night and they send them out at the daytime. And when you walk out on them, it's 1,100 feet to the street. So our family, my wife and our son, we were in Chicago a few years ago, and we go up to the Willis Tower, and we were eager because we'd heard about these things. We want to try them out. So there's a line, and the three of us were standing here, and there's a woman in front of us. And so there's the line, and there's the box, and the woman just... and she leaves. She can't go out on the box. I'm like, wow, I never even thought that people wouldn't want to go out in the box. Like, and I love going up. I love these kinds of, these observations, like up high places. I love this. And right, so my son, who's at the time was like a junior in high school, he walks out. He just walks out of the box, right? And my wife, she kind of walks out of the box. At which point my son like does one of these. He's out in the box, right? And he's like... I'm like, great. I could not walk into the box. And so I'm like, I can't really do it here because I really would fall. But it's this sense of you stick your toe onto the box and your toe holds and then you put your foot. And then you put your other foot halfway. And then you walk out into the box. Because your brain will not lie to you. And my brain is telling me it's 1,100 feet to the ground. It doesn't matter what the physicists tell me. what the mechanical engineers tell me, what my little hopping son, my 17, 18-year-old son is trying to tell me. All right. My brain's not going to lie to me. So if I have a memory in which being vulnerable, because this is what we are, right? We come out of the womb vulnerable. Our vulnerable state costs me. I'm not stupid. And so I might tell you a little bit, and we'll see what you do with that. And then I might tell you a little bit more, and we'll see what you do with that. And so forth and so on. And this is how stories are told. This is how vulnerability is enlarged. This is how trust is built. This is how healing emerges. This is how a world of goodness and beauty is co-created between us and the triune God.